cosmology, well, not really cosmology, but space travel. And I had a question for you. Is it still possible to ask such a question, such as whether or not you, what you think are the possibilities of life as we know it in the universe?
There are a couple of very respected recent articles, Roger, where by way of the Kepler Space Telescope, that's the one that was looking for planets going around other stars, and they finally put all that data together, and they've got thousands of candidate planets, and bear in mind, the method of searching was looking for a planet passing in front of that star, where only 1% of the planets are oriented correctly so you can see them. The other 99% you don't even see. When they put the statistics of that all together, they came to the conclusion that of all the stars out there, 10% of them have Earth-sized planets in the Goldilocks zone between the inner and outer solar system of that particular star. Let me repeat that. The current thinking is 10% of all the stars have an Earth-sized planet in the Goldilocks zone, where it's not too hot, not too cold, water will be in liquid form. Put that together with the Harold Urey and, I can't think of his name right now, the experiment that was done roughly 1956. Oh, I can't think of the guy's name. Urey was his doctoral advisor, and this particular guy did an experiment in which he took inert materials similar to what was present on the early Earth. Hydrogen, water, methane, and a couple of things like that, sterilized them, put them into a flask, passed steaming water through it, which simulates geysers, passed electrical sparks through it, simulating lightning, did it for a week, and at the end of that week, they had something like 13 amino acids that were created in those inert materials. Let me drop this. And when you apply modern-day instrumentation, which is much more sensitive than he had at the time, and they looked over the stored test tubes that he had from that experiment of 1956 after his death, they found that quite a few more of the amino acids were present in small percentages. They were below the detection of his equipment, and so of the 23 major amino acids required for life as we know it, some high percentage of them happened in this somewhat natural process. You could, if you were very optimistic, say that if that experiment was run long enough, life would crawl out of the flask. One possible explanation for all of this is that life as we know it appears to be spontaneous. There's another law of physics. Let me drop. Another universally accepted law of physics saying that if you have enough material interacting for a long enough period of time, every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. Wait long enough, it'll always happen. So we have good reason to believe that life will naturally happen on planet when you've got the right materials. On top of that, the discovering that many of the asteroids and comets also have organic materials on board, of what origin we don't know. So were the living materials of Earth deposited here by comets and asteroids is one particular question. Did it happen automatically? Did life first form at the geysers below the ocean? Did it first happen at the seashores? So there's lots and lots of evidence that life as we know it could very well be universal. There's 10% of all the stars out there have the capability. Let me drop it. So with all that statistics, Roger, if you wanted to think that we're unique, not likely, of all the life that's out there, I am guessing that half of it is ahead of us technologically, half of it's behind us technologically. You take a look at the fact that we've got a very nice planet in a very nice location of an average-sized star in an average position between downtown and suburbs of this galaxy, an average-sized galaxy in an average-sized galactic group, so that we're right in the middle of everything. It's a very desirable place to be, but I guarantee that some of those guys out there, some of that life has gotten a million years, maybe a billion years head start on us. For us to think, just like back in the very beginning, we thought that all the planets went around the Earth and the Earth was the center of the universe. Well, we've been downgraded with Hubble experiments, Hubble situations four or five times since then. And so we're not that great, if you know what I mean. I know it's there. Everything I know tells me the life is there. Now, whether or not they have gone through the ridiculously difficult problem of interstellar travel, I mean, if you can move at the speed of light, the very closest star to us is 4.3 light years away. Let me drop it. The fastest thing we have ever issued is the New Horizons spacecraft, which left the Earth vicinity, in my estimation, in the vicinity of 90,000 miles an hour with reference to the Sun, Pluto system. And so that's the fastest thing we've ever issued. And if you now send it toward the nearest possible star, Alpha Centauri, Proxima Centauri, it's going to take probably more than a million years to get there. As you can see, the distances are so great, the degree of difficulty is so high, that I think the number of visitations we've had of these other societies is quite small. There's another thing to consider, and that is, although it's science fiction from Star Wars, from Star Trek, the so-called Prime Directive, you don't interfere, you leave them alone, because if you encounter another society that's very different than yours in technological progress, and you make yourself known, there's a high probability you destabilize that society. So if these guys with high morality have visited the Earth, they might be actively trying not to be recognized, if you know what I mean. I don't know if that's correct, but by way of the Prime Directive of Star Trek, which makes very good science fiction, it might be accurate. Bunch of speculation, as you can tell, Roy. Juliet Alpha Sierra. Darn good question. And we're never going to get the simple answer to this one. K2RIW, the tech man. You got it, Roy.
Well, did you explain Donald Trump?
Wouldn't touch that.
Okay.
Talk about being out there. This is K2K. Okay. Craig, your views and mine are 99.9% in the complete alignment, and I thank you for stating these things. My further observation would be that if the universe is just teeming with life forms, and a significant percentage of them being our kind, I also think that in course of the distances involved, not likely in my estimation that people would travel, that life forms would travel those humongous distances to get to another place like Earth and then play hide and seek once they got here. So all of this hooey about UFOs visiting us and examining our genitals and making us up for their spacecraft and all this nonsense, my humble opinion, is just far-fetched malarkey to get to any place in the universe that may have sentient life like ours. Takes so much effort and time that if you really get to someplace interesting, you're not going to be playing hide and seek, regardless of the Prime Directive. But I think the contact with other life forms on a
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I have a comment.
Firmly appreciate that. There is organic material floating around out there, and it is being circulated and spread around. So that's it for me, and give me a call at it again. Is it Lima, Ida, Whiskey, Tequila to Lima, Ida, Whiskey, K2JAS.
Very fine, Roy. Eric recognized. Roger, and that is on K2 Romeo, India, Whiskey. And the segment has been around for 32 years, starting way back in September of 1982, every Sunday. Mankind and other beings make the majority of progress. when they display curiosity. It doesn't matter what the hell the subject of the curiosity is. If you really want to know how things work, how to make them work better, why they failed, are we alone? Are we the only things around? If you've got curiosity, you're going to explore things. So for them to make a lot of progress and decide to explore us, very, very likely. To interface with us, if they've got the technology to go to tremendous distances and tremendous velocities required, I'm not convinced that they would consider us worth talking to, so to speak. I mean, you and I can decide we're going to study that ant colony in our backyard, that bee colony in our backyard, and we're not going to try to communicate with them per se, but we're going to study them because we've got curiosity. How did something of such a lower capability as far as intelligence is concerned create such an extremely high efficiency society that works? How did that all come about? You and I could get that kind of curiosity. And for all I know, they might look at us in a somewhat similar manner. Let me drop. We had started off with tremendous arrogance in the beginning, thinking the Earth is the center of everything, and we're the smartest thing around, and the deity favored us over all other possible life forms. There's a lot of arrogance in that one, and slowly we're being humbled, as I see it, and we're about to be humbled again. I'm convinced that we're eventually going to discover that what we see as the observable universe is just one of many observable universes. For us to think that there's only one universe, there was only one Big Bang, and we're in the middle of that one, that takes a lot of arrogance. To think that there weren't multiple Big Bangs, multiverses, and so on. There's good evidence that that when you look at the ultra-deep field picture done by Hubble, and you look out at the perimeter, the greatest range that you've got in that photograph, and you would like to believe that, hey, you've seen the beginning, you've seen the end of everything because it's getting very sparse out there. Absolutely not. The density of galaxies out there is equal to the density in here, if you know what I mean. So we can't see all those galaxies because the ones that we don't see are beyond our visual horizon, so to speak, our observable 13.8 billion light years. Guaranteed there's a lot more out there. I'm convinced we're not alone, but whether or not we've been contacted, we can speculate on that one a whole lot. Eric's going to clear that up for us, though. K2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, you in essence really touched upon what I was going to say is that to make a decision like the previous gentleman, the thing that prevents science from going forward, you need to have that open mind. You know, Einstein's theories in terms of the fabric of space offers different possibilities that haven't touched upon. And as man learns, because the things that we're not aware of that might exist simply because we don't have the tools, some of them. I mean, we can look into the future and say, oh, well, you saw Dr. McCoy's scanner. Well, why not have a box that can read whatever this life energy is that we haven't defined? We can literally put all the DNA together and all the protoplasm and create the cell, but yet we don't know how to put that energy into the things to put it. Anything that we do with light is a continuation of light. It's never a creation of light. So if you believe in God, then that's where your mindset is. That's the ultimate thing to you. And to look further is like something that you've been taught not to do. You know, it's a philosophical thing here. Everybody's entitled to think the way they want to think and have their opinion the way it is. It's just that the universe is a lot bigger than what we know. We barely know what's in between the particles and the atom, let alone medicine know how to fix them. Although we're getting better at it, it's still not that good. K2RIW, K2J.
NY2HF, what a comment.
Go right ahead, Lou.
No, this is Dennis Dick.
Even so, you got it, Dennis.
I just wanted to add something to that. You know, the our planetary systems are like etch-a-sketches. If they get disturbed, they erase what's going on. We're about to go into a Maunder minimum, which the last time we did that, I think 400 years ago, we went into the Little Ice Age, where people walked across the Hudson from New York City to Staten Island. We also might be coming into a magnetic pole reversal because the poles are drifting quite extensively. So you may find that, you know, intellect was able to build up over time but got knocked out. We've had many extinctions on this planet already. So, you know, it might be a go one step forward, two steps back. It's just my thought. Back to that. NY2HF.
We have had five major mass extinctions on this planet already, and the last one was something like 65 million years ago, in which all of the dinosaurs died, as well as many other living items. And then life started all over again, and here we are. It's nice to look at the cartoons of the Flintstones, where dinosaurs and people look like they coexist. They missed each other by close to 65 million years. Whether or not we're going into a Maunder minimum is not clear, as I see it, Dennis. Yes, we're going to some kind of a minimum, but I don't think we're going all the way to a Maunder minimum. The cyclicity of the sun in that manner is something much, much longer. That Maunder minimum, I think, was, what was it, around the year 1600? Roughly, what was that year of the middle of the Maunder minimum? You probably know better than I do. How about you, Dennis?
I think it was around, I'm not positive either, but I think it was around 1690 or something like that, and it lasted for quite a long time. But, no, they're saying that it may start as early as 2023, of course they don't know, and or it may be a couple of decades. But all the indications are there with what's going on in the magnetosphere on Earth, what's going on the pole reversal on the sun, the sunspots, lack of sunspots, lack of electric reactivity on the sun. There's lots of things going on. And actually, it's funny because I never knew that the sun went to sleep, actually, until it builds up more plasma from, you know, being bombarded from things out in the out in space. And then reignites itself. I didn't realize that, but from what I'm seeing, that's where we're headed. And there's a lot of people saying it, and there's a lot of things going on that probably support that. But, you know, man is makes a lot of errors, so we don't know. Back to that.
By way of studying tree rings for the last zillion years, and studying the ice cores from the Arctic, Antarctic, Greenland, we can look at an awful lot of thousands of years of past history. There's a lot of evidence that the solar constant, the 1300 watts per square meter, the amount of sunlight hitting the Earth, has changed very little over all of that period. The sun going to sleep, I'm having trouble with that one. I mean, once you've got nuclear fusion going on in the center of the sun, to turn it off without first consuming the fuel, very unlikely. And there's no on-off switch on that one, I don't think. So that may be someone's speculation. It might not be accurate. So we've got lots of things to worry about, but I'm not sure the sky is falling quite that fast, if you know what I mean. And even if we are going into another ice age, nowadays with our technology, we're quite adaptable. If I had to burn twice as much oil in order to keep my house warm because we're going into a mini ice age, I'd bitch and moan a whole lot, but I would pay the price, I would buy the oil, and I would do it. Either that or I'd move to Florida or closer to the equator, if you know what I mean. There's all kinds of solutions. We don't let me drop. There are people who are thinking that in the near future we've got to abandon Earth and we've got to move to some other place, Mars, Venus, or whatever. Not likely. Very unlikely, in my opinion. Better make good use of what you've got here, because our ability to go to some other place that's worth living, not good. I guess it was about 2 or 3 months ago we were discussing the fact that there is a movement to have people on a one-way trip to Mars and live there. It's nice to study the problem as to what all is involved. I'm convinced that in our lifetime we're not going to see a human being standing on Mars. I've given you guys a bunch of reasons, the past where I think that's not likely. To send machines there at that very hostile environment to make measurements beautiful, to send a human being there, much, much too expensive. It would take a couple of trillion dollars in today's funding to do that. And it would take a contribution of multiple nations to finance it. Each of those nations, before financing, they're going to say, what do I get for my money? What do I get in return? I could be feeding a hell of a lot of people. Let me drop this. One of the major thrusts of the spacecraft being built by NASA, it's really studying all of the nine planets, that used to be called nine planets, eight planets plus a planetesimal, dwarf planet, but to study how they formed, relating that to Earth, and really finding out how many of these structures have the right conditions that could support life as we know it. One of the big things being searched directly or very indirectly by NASA is, are we alone? Is life possible in other places? Right now, in this pretty vast solar system that we live in, which is just an average-sized one, right now we only know of one place that really has life that we can confirm. That's a little bit disappointing. By now, we expected to find life forms in other places, but we haven't completely stopped that search. Okay, I think we've gone through all the people who signed in. Yes, I think we have. It's time to go over the mailbag. Sometimes that mailbag asks questions like, does electricity have weight? Oh boy, we haven't come close to settling that one yet. To be continued. KC2WGB. Go easy on this, John. K2RIW, the tech net.
KC2WGB. Very good. In fact, Glenn has some recent information that he received on the job with a conference with three PhDs. Maybe he'll be making us aware of what he has found. Yeah, here's a question that came in. Let me let it drop. Okay, this is a construct of an antenna system that is used to test exactly what we were talking about last week. He heard us on that subject. He's from Pennsylvania, and he's got a beautiful little testing lab he's built out. He has several acres, and he has an acre and a half of a clear meadow, which he has put this system up. Let me let it drop. All right, we were questioning testing two different types of basic antennas. You put up a dipole, you get a certain reading, then you put up another one. By the time you do that, you could have some of the parameters change, propagation, whatever. So how he solved that issue was he placed two poles spaced 90 feet apart at a height of 40 feet. Okay. On the top of that pole, he has a bolt coming through, so they're facing each other. That bolt is facing each other. Then he took a 10-foot length of pipe and put it on the pole like a propeller, sort of like a windmill on each one. But now we have two propellers facing each other. Well, at the end of one propeller, he strings a dipole, makes another dipole on the bottom. Plenty of different distance. He can make many different types of dipoles. And he's made bird cages. And when he makes a test on an antenna, he'll make a duplicate antenna, modify it, whether he puts a capacitor in series or whatever, and actually test. He's doing basically receive tests, not transmitting. He does both, but receiving is what he's interested in. Do you follow the construct so far, Dick?
Only partially do I follow it, and it does appear as though he's put forth a very heroic effort to build a pair of 40-foot poles, if I understand that correctly, in the middle of a couple of acres of flat property. And by way of the article that I wrote in, I think it's 1977, called Antenna Ratiometry, an Outdoor Antenna Improvement Technique. If you look at my call letters, K2RIW, do an archive search in QST magazine. This appeared in QST, this article. It also was an IEEE presentation that I made. So the antenna ratiometry range doesn't require a very big range. doesn't require a whole lot of cleared space, particularly does not require a lot of altitude for the antenna testing, and you get repeatability to the nearest quarter of a dB, half a dB. It has a resolution of a 20th of a decibel of increase or decrease, 0.05 dB of increase or decrease. And this ratiometry antenna range technique was selected by arguably the world's best outdoor antenna range, the antenna range at the Rome Air Development Center near Rome, New York, but it's actually closer to Utica. And I've done a couple of years of work at that facility. So there are slightly easier techniques that can give you a little bit easier, not as much construction, and yet results that are traceable to the Bureau. Let me drop this. The advantage of the ratiometry antenna range technique is that you're simultaneously comparing a reference antenna to the antenna under test, and you're only looking at the difference between the two in the receive mode. Therefore, the transmitter power can go up and down because Con Ed goes up and down in voltage. The reflectivity of the ground between the transmitting antenna and the antennas on the test can go up and down because the ground is drying out. And all of those get canceled by that technique. So to find a way of making an improvement on that technique is difficult, in my opinion. And some of the world's best antenna ranges think that this is the best way to go. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, well, he's doing this with almost no test equipment, just his radios. He has three field strength meters. They are receiver-type field strength meters located approximately a kilometer away in different directions. But the idea of this is when he builds the two antennas, one is a modified version of the first, all he has to do is rotate that windmill. It goes to the exact same elevation with the exact same direction and the exact same coupling to the earth. So measuring by listening and by transmitting, and he has several friends located a couple of miles away, and they make all kinds of tests. And he even in bird cages, and he found that there's very little difference between the structures on the dipole system, just like you mentioned, when they are tuned to resonance. They're much similar. He does notice some variations improving reception. So what he'll do is he'll rotate it so that the top antenna is up there. He'll take his readings, have it spun, so now the bottom antenna goes to the top. They're exactly in the same positions, same propagation factors, and he'll take other readings. Just a clever idea with very little, there's some construction work there, but he's got the property and he's having a lot of fun with this. But just to give you an idea of testing the antennas under the exact way they're used, pretty effectively.
There's a lot of education that you can get out of building an outdoor antenna range. And whenever do an outdoor antenna range, you're always getting ground reflection. Good common sense would lead you to believe that if you raise the antennas further and further above the ground, if you're transmitting between two tall buildings, for instance, one building's got the transmitter, the other building's got the receiving system and antenna on the test, and now you're multiple floors above the ground, you'd like to believe the ground reflection is now canceled out because of that distance. That's one approach, but it gives you a law of diminishing returns. The so-called Dick Turin technique, W2IMQ, has an article in, where can I find that? The ARO antenna book in the chapter that covers transmission lines and antenna testing. It's one of the later chapters. You read that section on what Dick Turin of Bell Laboratories developed. He found that if the source antenna is very close to the ground, at a very known proper distance above the ground, and the distance between the source antenna and the antenna on the test is at a known distance and known altitude, you literally take ground reflection as a benefit as opposed to a detriment, and you can use it in your favor. Every outdoor antenna range is going to have a lot of ground reflection. You can try to run away from that ground reflection, or you can use it in your favor, and the Turin technique uses it in your favor. Let me drop. you combine the low transmitting antenna testing procedure of W2IMU with the antenna ratiometry technique, you can get ridiculous amounts of repeatability and resolution of gain change. And the antenna you're testing is, in many cases, 8 feet off the ground. You're standing on a wooden ladder alongside of that antenna with tuning tools, and you're watching the performance of the antenna in real time as you hold a tuning tool near the tip of a dipole or a parasitic element, and that tunes it to a lower frequency. Or you hold a tuning tool near the center of the parasitic element that raises it to a higher frequency. And by way of using a voltage to frequency converter, where you're listening to a tone, and when the gain goes up, the tone goes up, you're hearing all of this in real time as you're doing the testing. I mean, to lower an antenna to the ground, make a change, and put it back up, that's kind of a piecemeal way of testing. In between the two, the measure, the change you just made, you may have moved something by an inch, and you went from a half inch too short to a half inch too long, so to speak. And if you had moved it by a quarter of an inch, or half an inch instead of a full inch, you may have seen a peak in performance that you walked over and didn't know it. When you're doing the testing in real time, in a continuous manner, there's a hell of a lot of serendipity takes place. That's how I discovered the so-called RAW-19 antenna, by testing it in real time. And I'm pretty sure the article I'm talking about, antenna ratiometry, I'm pretty sure it's on the website of Mike number two, which is limontechnet.com. I'm pretty sure that antenna article is there. I do recommend you read it, because it could save you a whole lot of time. And by the way, let me drop it. You may say that I used very little test equipment. I used only one piece of test equipment, the single generator, which was my ordinary 2-meter transmitter, 432 transmitter. I'll admit I had to modulate it, amplitude modulate it at a 1kc rate, because my particular ratiometer responds to 1kc. And my receiver consisted of two crystal diode detectors going into the one piece of instrumentation, a ratiometer. And ratiometers can be bought on the surplus market quite inexpensively. There are now articles telling you how to build a ratiometer. And there's ways that you can put a switching diode network on your ordinary receiver and get that function. So only one piece of test equipment is required. And it doesn't have to be an expensive piece of test equipment. But to do antenna testing in real time, where you watch the gain go up and down a tenth of a dB at a time, so to speak, and you're getting in a continuous response as to whether or not you're making an improvement or a detriment, and whether you're measuring gain or standing wave ratio, doesn't matter, you can be getting a continuous display of the improvement or the detriment. I think that's a way that has to be considered. What your man from Pennsylvania has done is a good technique that may be a simpler technique you should also consider. That's an opinion. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, the reason he did this, don't forget now, to switch antennas takes him about 10 seconds. He just has to rotate those two blades. So it made it very simple for him. There's no chance of ground reflection changing, or the position of the antenna being inaccurate, or the altitude being inaccurate, or the length changing. So it's just a poor man's way of doing that, I guess you could say, antenna analyzing. And he'll use his little antenna analyzer that he does have to compare the antenna to the readings. And any change he makes to the antenna, what actually is happening with the antenna analyzer, and then, of course, listening to the reception of a steady signal that he knows he's locked on, and that signal will not change, not like in 10 seconds, even for whether he's listening to a beacon or not. And he does it over a long period of time, and he's found some interesting things about antennas. But just wanted to let you know, people are out there really using their brain. Back to you, Dick.
Under normal testing circumstances, doing outdoor range antenna testing, picking up the gain and or standing wave ratio, can be a slightly humbling experience. There's a lot of things can go wrong with that one. I'm now on Mike number two's website, That's www.limarctechnet, all run together, limarctechnet.com. Now, when you go to that website, there's four or five yellow boxes on the left-hand side. You go to the fourth yellow box, and you'll find the article called UHF Antenna Ratiometry. And when you read that article, you'll find out how much more simple. In other words, you can do testing of higher accuracy, less vulnerability to the transmitter going up and down in power, less vulnerability to the ground reflection going up and down in reflectivity, and getting the results, the answer, in real time, continuously, while you're doing the testing with that technique. I didn't say he should abandon his current technique. I'm saying he should look at this other approach, and then maybe he can borrow some of the techniques of this other approach, add it to his approach, and get the best of both worlds. He's described a technique that is a little bit enthusiastic. The average guy to do antenna testing is not going to put up a pair of 40-foot high poles with propellers on them. He's made a very good effort, but he's not getting a continuous answer. And all of the, could say, each of the antenna patents that I have filed, I found the performance I was looking for by way of a continuous real-time testing technique in which I'm looking at a display screen or I'm listening to a tone and I'm millisecond by millisecond watch the gain go up or down as I'm making continuous changes that allowed me to find antenna repeater timeout. That allowed me to find antenna tuning techniques that were much better than I would have found by any other way. I mean, each time you rotate the propeller to make a change of the antenna and go back to the right altitude and make a judgment, I mean, each minor change, we're talking about a couple of minutes of change in time. I could be getting that answer in a couple of seconds if I'm doing continuous testing with real-time display. As such, I can do 1,000 experiments in a day's time, so to speak, whereas by other techniques, a person would have trouble doing 10 experiments. And they say 10 experiments are discontinuous experiments. To have a continuous display of gain while you're changing some particular parameter of the antenna, and you're getting the answer in real time, you've made how valuable that technique is. Each time I describe this to people who have never done it, their eyes glass over, and they don't know what I'm talking about because it's so different than anything they've ever heard of before. So it's a matter of acceptance or non-acceptance of a slightly newer technique. Much of opinions on my part, as you can tell, John. And by the way, I'll go back to you with this one, with some more if you want to, or you can go to the next one. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. No, I think it's well covered. He can visit that website. I'm sure he's listening. And maybe he can pick up some tips. I don't know at that elevation how he would be able to bring, strips of metal. He used a bamboo pole with something on it. Maybe he could go up and try to get something to couple to the antenna. That's possible. But as long as he could find out more information, I'm sure he's going to be happy. But this seems to be working well for him. All right, let me drop on one for the second one.
With the techniques of that article, the antenna absolutely doesn't have to be 40 feet above the ground. It only has to be 8 or 10 feet above the ground for 432 testing of high-performance Yagi antennas. And you stand on a wooden Yagi with a wooden pole in your hand that's a wooden stick that's one of these skewers for barbecuing with a piece of copper tape on the end of it. And now you're doing testing in real time. You don't need altitude. That's not... It's a belief that people used to have. When you read that technique, you'll find out it can be done a hell of a lot simpler, with a hell of a lot more accuracy, and a hell of a lot shorter time to get real-time, continuous answers. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Yeah, very convenient with Yagis, but this is basically long wire stuff. I think the shortest antenna he was dealing with was like 55 feet. And he can go to 80 feet without a problem. So, he's working in the HFs on this particular thing. But, it's
known is that antennas do a beautiful job of scaling. If he's building an HF antenna on 80, 40, 20 meters, where the antenna, if it was a loop antenna, it's a full wavelength loop, we're talking about a lot of real estate, you know, 260 feet of wire in a loop for an 80-meter loop antenna. If he decided to scale that to 1296, which is going to bring the size down by 100 to 1 or maybe 500 to 1, so to speak, as long as you change every single dimension of an antenna when you go to a higher frequency by the ratio of the wavelengths, you'll get the exact same performance in gain, then wave ratio, bandwidth, and whatever. So to do big antenna testing at VHF frequencies and then scale it back down to your frequency can give you a lot of bang for the dollar. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, that might be something he could handle easier if he works on the higher frequencies and then scale it. Yeah, that, I could see that being done, and it might make it a little easier for him. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one. KC2WGB. All right. Here's a crafty one. And this gentleman wants to know, what has he done, or what has he accomplished, and how does it work? He has a long wire antenna. I believe it's an 80-footer from his drawing. Now, what he did was on the antenna element itself, that wire, let's see, it's 14-gauge wire, put three ferrite rings on the antenna itself. Okay. Now, what he does, he slides a ring toward the center of the antenna, and he'll take his readings and do his antenna analyzer and this and that. Then he takes that ring and he twists it 180 degrees until that ring now has a loop around it. And he can do that with three rings. And he's noticing difference in the tuning by quite a lot. So what is he actually playing with the back key of KC2WGB?
Yeah, that is a fascinating experiment. Whenever you take a ferrite, toroid, iron pyrotoroid, any magnetic material that's in the donut shape, and you put a piece of wire through it, depending on the size of your magnetic material, its cross-sectional area, its diameter, and the frequency you're operating at, you get a huge increase in the inductance of the piece of wire that goes through. An ordinary piece of wire, I'm talking about 18-gauge pushback wire that you wire a circuit with, and it's sitting above a printed circuit board at a reasonable distance. A rough rule of thumb is you get 18 nanohenries, 23 nanohenries per inch. Each inch of wire that you use on a circuit you might build, 22 nanohenries per inch. When you put a ferrite around it, if the ferrite happens to have permeability. If it happens to have permeability of 1,000, and some materials do, that means you get 1,000 times more inductance because the magnetic field flows around that wire 1,000 times better than it would through air. That's what permeability of 1,000 of the material means. Let me drop it. I'll make a very rough guess. Your piece of wire going through your toroid now doesn't have 22 nanohenries per inch. It's got 22 microhenries per inch. The bottom line of all this is that you've now got a significant inductor. Even though you think you've only got a straight piece of wire going through the middle of your donut, you've got a significant amount of inductance. When you now grab that donut and twist it by rotating it so that the wire now comes out of that donut and goes through a couple of turns before it continues to the left and to the right, you've now created, assuming now that this wire is enameled wire, or it's got wire with insulation on it. If it's wire with insulation, by that twisting, you've now created a shunt capacitor across those two wires. If it's insulated, it might be enameled wire or insulated wire, and you've created a capacitor. You've now created a capacitor across an inductor. The inductor is what's going through the donut, the toroid, and now you've got a tuned circuit. Depending on how much you twist it, that tuned circuit is going up and down in frequency. By the way, a very effective gimmick capacitor. When you need a gimmick capacitor at VHF and UHF frequencies, let me drop. is to bring two insulated pieces of wire off the printed circuit board and twist them together. And as you twist them together for a long enough length and tighter twist, you're changing the amount of capacitance. And by the way, that's a very high performance gimmick capacitor in building when you do that. Now, if in his case, if the 14-gauge copper wire is bare copper wire, as he twists it together, he's now shorting out the inductor. The inductor is no longer there, except it is still a lumpy device, adding an extra chunk of capacitance to the universe at that particular point along his antenna. So if it's bare wire, he's shorting it out, and the inductance goes away, and he's got this lump of capacitance to the universe, a small one. If it's insulated wire, he's making a gimmick capacitor that's across the inductor, and he's now got a tuned circuit. And as a tuned circuit, it's now like a trap dipole, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, he's using insulated wire, regular electrical 14-gauge.
That he's building a gimmick capacitor with that twist, and as he twists it more and more, he's adding more and more capacitance by way of a grid-dip oscillator, grid-dip oscillator. He could put that near the toroid and measure the resonant frequency if he wanted to. As he changes the amount of twists and he changes the resonant frequency of this so-called trap dipole, that's a beautiful tuning technique. That's one that I haven't heard about. I'm going to tuck that away in the back of my mind as a very crafty tuning technique. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, it's very good that you mentioned the twisting technique because he only rotates it 180 degrees. I don't know if he's afraid to twist it or not. All right, that's one issue. Because he said this way, it changes from the conductor just going through a toroid to it actually looping around as if you had wound it around the toroid, and that he thought would give him an inductive effect. But that's interesting when you say if he wound it up, what would happen? Something else he could play with. Great.
Let me add some words to that one. The magic about a toroid is that if you had a piece of wire going straight through the donut hole, and a current is flowing in that wire, and if my thumb points in the direction of the current, and my finger's wrapping around the wire, that shows the direction that the magnetic field wants to form around that wire. And because you've put this donut material around the wire, through the wire through the donut, now those lines of magnetic field that want to flow around the wire have the ability to flow through your donut. The donut, if it has a permeability of 1,000, and some materials do, that means the magnetic field flows through the donut 1,000 times better than it flows through air. Therefore, the apparent inductance of the wire going through the toroid gets multiplied by close to 1,000 in nanohenries per inch, so to speak. The thing that's hard to believe is that whether the wire goes straight through the toroid or whether you go through the toroid with a U-shaped piece of wire in the middle, and now the wire is coming to wrapping around the toroid, you would think you're making tighter coupling to the toroid, and you're changing the inductance. The answer is you're not. Until one of those ends of the wire goes through the hole of the donut a second time, now you're going to the first demonstration of a second turn, so to speak. So no matter how you lay the wire with a U-shape on the outside, think you're changing the amount of magnetic coupling to the toroid. You're not. It's opposite of common sense. So the wire being closer to the toroid, you can, by the same token, you can do an experiment where you have the wire going right down the center, but now you move it off to the center, off to one side, and you think you're making a big change in the inductance. You're not. Very, very minor change. So until one of the loops of the wire, and one of the ends of the wire, goes through the hole a second time,
repeater, timeout.
Until it goes through the hole a second time, you haven't changed the amount of inductance that you get. So, of course, that's not common sense, but that's the way toroids act. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, just make sure we have it correct. So if you go through a toroid with a straight through connection, that's exactly the same as placing one turn around the toroid?
careful now. That's ambiguous wording. No matter how you dress the wire that goes through the hole, if the wire goes through the hole only once, then there is only, whether you call it one turn or a half turn is a matter of semantics, but you've got one coupling to the toroid. You will not change the coupling to the toroid until one of the ends of wire goes through the center hole a second time. Anything short of that, whether you call it a half turn or one turn, doesn't matter. You're making no difference. Until you put one of the ends of the wire through a hole the second time, now you're making a difference. Over to you, John. K2LIW.
DBZ with a comment.
And as I mentioned earlier, Hal, when he now twists the wire that's insulated on the outside of the toroid, so that he's making a shunt capacitor with the wire going through the toroid, he's really making an LC resonator. And you're one of the guys who really loves a grid dip oscillator. He could hold his grid dip oscillator there and find out what resonant frequency he's got as he changes the number of twists. K6DPZ, K2LAW, great, Hal.
Everybody on the tech there. I haven't been on for a while. Busy moving my airplane to my driveway. Okay, I just wanted to mention something about toroids, maybe Dick didn't bring up. If you want to measure the resonance for, or the inductance of a toroid, or make a resonance circuit, LC circuit on a toroid, take a one-turn loop in the toroid and go over to a grid dip meter with another loop. And you can dip the toroid and get a very accurate reading. It's like link coupling the toroid to the grid dip, and it works phenomenally.
Yeah, but because the Q of a toroid has a inductor that's part of a resonant circuit, in other words, if the wire that goes to the toroid center just once, and now those two ends of the wire have a capacitor across those two ends, and in this particular case, he is taking that wire, those two ends, and twisting them around each other as a gimmick capacitor, and the wire is insulated. He's now got a shunt capacitor across that inductor, and it is my belief, Hal, that that Q will be high enough that just holding the grid dip meter near that network, you don't even have to make another loop to the grid dip meter. Holding the grid dip meter near that network, he's going to measure a resonant frequency, in my belief. K6DPZ, K2LIW. By the way, Hal, make sure you wait for the beeps.
I'll be a good boy and wait for the beep. Now, as my experience with toroids, Dick, I found it's very hard to get a dip by just putting a grid dip meter close to the toroid. When you link it to the grid dip meter, then you can get a good dip. It doesn't really load the toroid because you're not making a few turns, just going right through the toroid with a wire and then having the wire loop around the coil of a grid dip meter loosely coupled. And you can get the very sharp resonant point to the toroid. And if you have a big C that you know about and you read the grid frequency, you got the inductance to the toroid.
Now, I'm going to take the information you just gave us, Hal, and I'm going to build on it. Instead of taking that wire that goes through the toroid once and bringing the two ends together and twisting them to make a gimmick capacitor, if he allows the wire to be a little bit longer so that there's an air gap between the outer perimeter of the toroid and where he starts twisting the wires together, he's made an intentional air gap there by not twisting it real close to the toroid. He's twisting it 3 inches away. And now he puts the coil of his grid dip meter in that space. As far as the grid dip meter is concerned, it thinks there is a one-turn link around the grid dip meter, as well as the one-turn link around the toroid, as well as the twisted gimmick capacitor on the far side. Guarantee he's going to measure a very sharp resonance when he does that. So you don't even have to make a separate loop around the grid dip meter. Just put it inside that air gap in this diagram that I tried to draw. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
Introducing passive coupling, basically, where I'm introducing more of an inductive type of coupling. Both methods work there. I found my methods work very well when I'm working with very large inductive toroids, where we're measuring them with, say, millihenries and so on and so forth. Higher frequency, you could get away doing it with your method. That would be acceptable.
Very fine, Hal. As I see it, John, he's made a very crafty observation. By way of his curiosity, he's asking what he's doing, and he's really building an LC parallel resonant network that so-called gimmick capacitor. He's afraid to twist more than 180 degrees. There's all kinds of experiments he can do by twisting 360 and 720 degrees because he's now making a twisted gimmick capacitor. As the number of external twists increase, he is increasing the shunt capacitor in that location. Therefore, he's lowering the resonant frequency. And whether he puts a real variable capacitor in that location or makes the so-called gimmick capacitor by twisting, that gimmick capacitor is very high in performance. And so it's a poor man's way of making a very good variable capacitor. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good idea, Dick. So from what I understand, if he were to produce what looks like a hangman's noose, he could put his dip meter right in that noose, and by the amount of turns he puts on that coil, he would be able to change the results. That's something I'm sure he hasn't done. That sounds great.
You got it, John. And guarantee he'll measure that resonant frequency. Now, life is a little bit complicated because the LC network he has just created, without a doubt, is a resonant frequency device. However, the rest of the wire of the antenna, going to the right, to the right-hand insulator, and going to the left-hand insulator, it also is a resonator in free space. By way of the Brown and Woodward curves, which again are at those two websites, you can figure out what length of wire, what diameter of wire, and therefore at your particular operating frequency, what is the amount of inductance or capacitance of that wire. So the rest of the wire coming out of the twisted area, going to the right and to the left, is an additional reactor to the outside world, changing the resonant frequency that he's going to measure. That means the measurement is going to seem a little bit complicated, but still, he could temporarily cut those wires to the right and to the left, make the measurement of his network, or build another one just like it, and then re-solder them back together in order to find out what is the real resonant frequency of his local LC network of that toroid plus the twisted capacitors. So, not quite as simple as we'd like, but still a beautiful experimenter's tool. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the TechNet.
More comments, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Al. Wait for the beeps. Give us your other comment.
If a toroid is already mounted in a circuit, and you find out that you have too much inductance on the toroid, instead of taking it out, wind some copper wire in the reverse direction on the toroid and short it, and you'll cancel out as much inductance as you want to cancel out on how many turns of the reverse copper wire you put in there and short it.
And that's another good tuning tool, Hank, Hal. In the case of a transformer, where a good transformer that's running on 60 cycles, you've got enough turns of the primary winding that it's a high enough inductor, enough millihenries, so that it's a high enough inductive reactance that the amount of current the transformer draws when it's unloaded is a very low number, typically milliamperes. If the transformer had a shorted turn on that primary or secondary winding, all of a sudden the apparent inductance of that primary goes to near zero real fast. And therefore, now the resonant frequency of your primary winding of your transformer goes way, way higher. By the same token, you can put one turn or a number of turns, what Hal is saying, short circuit, separate chunk of wire also going through the toroid, could drastically lower its inductance if that's what you wanted to do, to raise its resonant frequency. Not too different from what goes on with a 60-cycle clock, the so-called split-phase synchronous motor that's in many 60-cycle clocks. If you study what's inside of that, there is a short turn of copper wire across a portion of the inductor, which gives you a phase shift, which makes a rotating magnetic field, which makes it a synchronous motor. So